You can leave it over there somewhere.
In the event that I stop talking before we finish tonight, we have an extra microphone if we end up doing questions and answers, but I can't guarantee I'll stop talking. So I have a few things on my mind. It's a strange event for me because I often come up here and I have no idea what I'm going to say, but something came to me while I was sitting just in appreciation of just the nature, the miracle of the consciousness that through which each of us perceives, just the fact of awareness, the fact of that it takes absolutely no effort for you to perceive what I'm saying, that consciousness of hearing arises spontaneously, feeling, all of that depends on this ever-available presence of awareness. And it's often something that we think we have to create, something that we've lost that then has to be found, something that we have to become. And therefore, there's this great striving for awareness when it is the most fundamental, most natural thing to each of us. It's what I think allowed the Buddha to, while sitting under the Bodhi tree, when his mind stopped striving so hard, stopped searching, stopped grasping, stopped condemning, stopped trying to become somebody, trying to make more a better me. When all of that stopped and his mind relaxed a little bit, in a flash of insight, he realized that the very freedom that he had been searching for was none other than the nature of his own mind, the nature of each of our minds. So close that it's hard to see, like trying to see our own face. But nevertheless, all the wisdom teachings, I think, in all traditions point to the fact that in some fundamental way, no effort is needed to wake up to our true nature. Because it's already what is awake and perceiving in this very instant. We rather need to make effort to notice all the ways that we occlude or cloud or block or obscure that natural wakefulness, that natural freedom, that what the Tibetan teacher Nosho Ken calls natural great peace. And in the Advaita tradition or other more Hindu-related traditions there, I think of the great ecstatic saint, Ramakrishna, who probably many of you have read. He's really fun to read, his utterings. He would just sit around the garden hanging out with people, and he would then just naturally be pulled into the seclusion of the nature of his own mind. Just his mind would withdraw from external mindfulness for a moment and be pulled into to not just internal objects of mindfulness, but the internal nature of consciousness itself. And he'd just sit there for a while and everybody would be hanging out in the garden, and then he'd finally open his eyes. And just spontaneously, he would just start letting out a song of freedom. And one of them that I found just so beautiful, he just opened his eyes one day and he said, "Oh, longing mind, dwell within the depths of your own pure nature. Do not seek your home elsewhere. Do not confine your innate infinity within the mansions of name and form, of finitude. Your naked awareness alone, O mind, is the inexhaustible abundance for which you long so desperately. And then he goes about his business, completely ordinary, laughing and crying, and then some other little line. But not because he has some kind of privileged nature of mind, it's because he just recognized what all of us already have within us. One of my teachers, an Advaita master named H.W.L. Punja, said it took him 40 years to realize that it takes no effort to realize your true nature. It's the cessation of effort. Of course, there's a little paradox here. There's a paradox that says, yes, freedom is the end of seeking and striving, but only those who seek seem to find it. But really, that could be easily taken as an excuse to strive, so that someday you'll realize your true nature. And that, I think the point that he was making is that I realize this, don't strive so hard. You don't have to do this. I've done it. I've spent 40 years trying to figure it out. You don't need to spend 40 years. Just be who you are. And don't stray away from that ever-present, available realization of your natural freedom. That nirvana is you. Nirvana is here in this very room. This very body, as Hakuin Zen Master says, this very body is the Buddha. This is the Pure Land. Now, how many of you are convinced that you have to do something? You have to become someone to be awake. You have to make all kinds of effort. Like I said, it's not. It takes a lot of effort to stay awake, to see what it is that binds us. In fact, I have a I thought I had that passage with me. Maybe I don't. But I like this passage from Peter Matheson. Soon the child's clear eye is clouded over by ideas and opinions, preconceptions and abstractions. Does that sound familiar? Simple free being becomes encrusted in the burdensome armor of the ego. Not until years later does an instinct come that a vital sense of mystery has been withdrawn. The sun glints through the pines, the heart is pierced in a moment of beauty and strange pain, like a memory of paradise. After that day, we become seekers. There's a wonderful old, often repeated parable called the Lost Necklace. This is just one version of it. No special effort is necessary to realize one's true nature. All efforts are eliminating the present obscuration to the truth. A lady is wearing a necklace around her neck. She forgets it, imagines it to be lost, and impulsively looks for it here, there, and everywhere. Not finding it, she asks her friends if they found it anywhere, until one kind friend points to her neck and tells her to feel the necklace around her neck. The seeker does so and feels happy that the necklace is found. Again, when she meets other friends, they ask her if her lost necklace was found. She says yes to them, as if it were lost and later recovered. Her happiness at rediscovering it around her neck is the same as if some lost property was recovered. In fact, she never lost it nor recovered it. And yet she was once miserable and now she's happy. So also is with the realization of your true nature. or your Buddha nature. So I just wanted to point to that ever-present fact tonight. But then in the other half of this is the effort that is required to notice where our minds have gotten confused. Notice which habits of ours lead us to that sense of having lost something, to that sense of being the one wave that's gotten separated from the ocean, to the qualities or states of mind that make us feel that happiness is not available to us here, that it must be for other people. And that's just examples of that are the comparing mind, constructing ourselves as not good enough or better than everyone else, or whatever it is that creates this sense of isolation and separation and makes us irritable and irritating and makes us feel that the world has to change in order for us to find our true nature, and everybody else has to change, or we have to change. And so for all of that, for all of the tendencies of mind that keep us bound, it is very useful to make effort to keep planting the seeds in our daily life that keep pointing us to that ever-present reality of freedom and all the qualities that come with an open heart and a sense of presence that is our true nature but gets obscured. So the Buddha had a beautiful list of what he called the paramis, or the perfections, those qualities that are an innate expression of our purity, an innate expression of that true nature that's always here, that necklace that was already around her neck. But these qualities tend to have been given, they've gotten weakened by the poisons that tend to play in our mind, or the poisons of greed, the poisons of hatred, the poisons of ignorance, or misidentification, misperception of reality. And the everyday burden of falling into the wiles or the temptations of the voices in our mind that are sometimes represented by the mythical figure Mara, who sends us all kinds of messages of, I have to, we've talked a lot on Tuesday night about the messages of the notion that some kind of temporary pleasure of body or mind, some kind of pleasure will make me happy. And the seeking of that pleasure just increases our sense of dissatisfaction, narrows our focus, has the effect when we listen to that voice of Mara that assumes that we have to, whatever it is on your list of what you have in order to be happy, just keeps reinforcing the sense that if I don't have that, I'll be miserable. Because our mind is shaped by the way we think. And so Mara represents the voice of inclination toward sense pleasures. Mara reinforces the feeling and the voice in our mind of dissatisfaction. That sense there's something wrong with me, and I'm not satisfied. And this idea, even though it has to be respected as a sign, it should be respected as a sign that we have left our what's already here, rather than a sign that we need to go out of ourselves in search, which just reinforces and increases the sense of dissatisfaction. The voice of Mara that is just caught in an insatiable hunger and thirst. So I'm sharing with you right now what are called the 10 armies of Mara. And that's a little bit of a militaristic term, so I don't often use that, but that's some of the language of the way the teachings were offered, that Mara will continually bring to your, for you to battle with or to contend with these forces in your mind of temptation. And Mara is often sometimes called the demon or sometimes called the devil. But Mara really doesn't want you to do anything bad. Mara just wants to keep you on the wheel of samsara, the wheel of endless becoming, endless striving. Doesn't want you to settle back and discover that effulgence of being that you are, that when you stop straying away from yourself. So Mara says, get lost in pleasure, feed the wanting mind. That's the number one army of Mara. Dissatisfaction, hunger and thirst, craving, sloth and torpor, dullness of mind. This is another one of the voices of Mara. Fear, paranoia, perplexity. This is also one of the armies of Mara. Fear, worry, anxiety. That will tend to spawn a lot of disembodiment and searching, something external to relieve our anxiety, when really that the anxiety, the fear, needs to be used as a call back to the awareness that knows that this is fear. And so then anxiety becomes, as we talk about a lot here, becomes, as Trungpa Rinpoche said, the manure of Bodhi. The very thing that tempts us to go out of ourselves becomes that part of our path that brings us home. So we have pleasure, sense pleasures, dissatisfaction, hunger, thirst, craving, sloth and torpor, fear, paranoia, doubt, the voices of doubt. I can't. He can't. We can't. It's not going to work. Discouragement, all of that. This is just an absolute fiction that our mind tells that keeps us bound in a state of diminishment, state of smallness. It's just the voice of doubt. This is Mara. And then the voice of conceit. The way the Buddha talked about this is very much as I did before. Conceit and mana. Mana is the word for pride or conceit, but it's mostly describes the comparing mind, the measuring mind, the mind that puts us above others, that's worried about making sure that we're equal to others or puts ourselves below others. This is another voice of Mara that's keeping you on this endless wheel of thinking that that you can somehow master you can become the best, constantly measuring good, better, best, good enough. And all of that is it's a fabrication. It's an overlay on reality that misses the inherent beauty in each person, in each thing, the connection of all life. It's so easily lost while we're busy comparing. Gaining reverence and fame, another one of those that seems to be driven by mana or conceit. And that's another just voice of Mara, as though that is truly going to make somebody happy. What a joke. Because fame is usually followed by shame, praise followed by blame, gain followed by loss. This is just the winds, the worldly winds that blow through everybody's life. So any one of these polarities is an unreliable refuge. It's just Mara keeping you on the wheel of searching for something you can't find in the world of changing conditions. And last, the internal voice of self-exaltation is considered one of the armies of Mara. Just that inflated, just being carried away with our own specialness. It's so inherent that we don't need to be carried away with it. We just need to experience it, be it. It's all just extra, yet we exhaust ourselves, exalting in our wonderfulness. So anyway, I think you get the idea that the armies of Mara are seductive. And the way that the Buddha suggested that we counter that is to train ourselves in their antidotes, essentially. I'm not going to offer the antidotes to each of those, but to just to more point to the qualities that best express our living as our natural, our true nature, all our natural wholesome qualities that seem to flow from being present, being awake. And the first one that Tara alluded to in our intermission is the first parami that the Buddha was considered to have developed to perfection is the quality of generosity. It's the first parami, the first teaching that the Buddha offered to lay people like us. Something that melts away the feeling of separate, that weakens the feeling of hunger and increases the feeling of fullness, the practice of every day in whatever way we're capable of, and it's a process and it's an evolution, but in whatever way possible, we practice giving. We practice generosity. The very act of it produces joy. It's joy. We can have joy in the thought of it, joy in the act of it, joy in the memory of it. It brings joy to the giver. It brings joy to the receiver. It's one of those things that melts away that separateness and gives us a felt experience that we're already home, that we don't need to become somebody different. We just need to let the qualities that are innate in our hearts flow and not let a single day pass without... Well, he said, if we knew how powerful this is, we wouldn't let a single meal pass without sharing it. But I would say, if we knew how powerful this force is, we wouldn't let a single day pass without making some kind of offering of generosity to a friend, a voice, a gesture, a hug, whatever it is. But to follow that impulse that is so natural in our hearts to give, and not to give in to the voice of fear. It's really a counterbalance to fear and lack and clinging. So there's generosity, and then last week I talked about one of the counterbalance for the tendency to fall into the counterfeit coins of the feeling of not telling the truth or stealing or whatever, or taking intoxicants that may just give you a little pleasure but then makes our world and our life crazy. Instead, practicing every day, letting virtue, morality, ethics be the guiding light of your life so that you can offer to yourself the bliss of blamelessness and offer that gift of fearlessness, that no one has to fear you because your life expresses that purity of action to go along with the pure nature of awareness. So virtue, so we've got generosity, virtue, renunciation, that you actually practice counterbalancing the tendency toward greed and hatred, and you renounce those impulses through the cultivation of loving kindness and restraint, simplicity. We can do that. We're all trainable. I don't know, does this give you any confidence or does it feel daunting? For some reason, this is, we're faced with this every day, this possibility of strengthening these. And there, it's as Sylvia Boorstein, my colleague and friend, titled her first book, "It's Easier Than You Think." What's really hard is staying unconscious. That's hard. That's what makes us bound up, our nervous systems tense and vibrating and unable to really relax into the nature of life. Because we don't get fed when we act out. But we get fed every time that we exercise restraint, or we practice non-harming, or we practice generosity. And then the fourth parami or perfection is wisdom. Every day, developing our wisdom and our understanding. Try to realize the Four Noble Truths, at least if we're talking about this context. Open to dukkha wherever you see it. It's not something wrong. This is how it is. Open to the cause of it. See all the ways in your own mind and body that dissatisfaction is increased through craving, through clinging, through condemning, through that endless waiting for the future that never arrives. And then, in terms of the cultivation of the parami of wisdom, abandon the cause. Let go. To me, the cultivation of wisdom is cultivating, it's synonymous with letting go. It's also synonymous with equanimity. Developing that unshakable evenness of mind. And how do we do that? We develop the other paramis. We do that which enhances every day our vital energy. Don't do anything that zaps your energy. Do everything that feeds it. What does that look like? Eat well. Exercise. Do everything you can to sleep well. Make sure that you breathe fresh air. All the things that everybody knows how to do to stay healthy. You can't make excuses about this. And notice your mind saying, well, I don't like to exercise. What? Doesn't matter. Do it. Our mind will find so many excuses. And yet we have an inexhaustible energy. And so that the other way to plug into that inexhaustible resource is to stay present. And that's really the navigator. Being mindful is the navigator that allows all of these qualities to grow. So we have generosity, virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience. That's just the counterbalance for impatience or ill will, aversion. So much restlessness and aversion. Patience, really cultivating that habit of breathing, of staying in our body, of noticing, knowing how to exercise the sacred pause. How to pause. How to recognize to me, impatience comes from the habitual mental state of rushing. That has nothing to do with speed, really. It has something to do with speed, but it has much more to do with the habit of a mind that's a little bit frenzied. And so it's noticing that it's starting to use that moment of rushing as a reminder to soften, to pause, to try not to act out of a state of rushing. Doesn't mean that you do things slowly. But it can help if you do the things you can do slowly. But can't get into that too much tonight. Last week I talked about truthfulness, telling the truth. Just that telling ourselves the truth, telling others the truth, authenticity. Just making a commitment to the truth. Not a commitment to, as Ashkvagosa said, committing to a life of, not to a life of self, but a life of truth. Because it is such an expression of our boundless interdependent nature. Because the moment you tell an untruth, you're declaring to yourself that you're not, that you're not connected to everything, that you're not the fullness of life, that you're protecting some kind of separate little compartment of me and mine. And that's a fundamental delusion. So telling the truth is an expression of our vastness. Because the true direction of all practice is from the narrow vortex of isolation to the wide gravitational field of interdependence and interbeing. To the seeing through the self-illusion and seeing through the illusion of other. That's really all. It's all about that, so that we actually can feel at home in this world instead of apart from the flow of life. So just a few more. The eighth parami is resolve, or just determination, resolved. And sometimes we tend to get, we lose a sense of determination, lose a sense of whatever that fire is, of resolve to stay with things. It's kind of the fire in the belly. And we can think that, oh, I don't have that, or somebody else has that, I don't have that. But it's within everyone. And it's simply a matter of inclining our hearts to be resolute in our practice, to, as Ajahn Sumedho says, determined to be awakened, not to be conceited or foolish, but determined. Even when the going is rough, remind yourself of the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, as he would say. Letting go of despair, letting go of anguish, letting go of everything that we habitually cling to and identify with. And so you just keep going. You keep letting go, moment by moment. This is what helps us keep remembering our true nature. And of course, we cannot get through the list of paramis without talking about loving kindness. Loving kindness is the face of emptiness, is the face of openness. If you're open, you can't help it but express loving kindness. But our minds have become so contracted in aversion that they need to sometimes consciously be inclined toward goodwill. So every day, under your breath, by action, word, thought, wish people well. Wish yourself well. I discovered walking up Dolores Street in the first 18 years of leading the sitting group, or 20 years or whatever, I lived on Dolores Street. I would have my meal, a little small meal, at the what used to be called the Real Good Karma restaurant that then became the Dolores Street Cafe. And I would do that before the sitting group. Then I would walk up the hill to the sitting group, and it became my ritual to walk up that hill. And it didn't matter how contracted I was, how tired I was, how much I didn't feel like going and leading a group or anything, but on the way up the hill, I would do my metta phrases. May I be happy, may I be peaceful. And mine were really simple in those days. Happy, peaceful, free of suffering. May I live with ease. And just that gesture of kindness, of bathing in the, of well-wishing, of giving myself some attention, some kind attention, it was transformative. I would marvel, and I would often share on the Tuesday nights that I had just gotten done doing that, and I was just amazed at how different I felt. So inclining toward the purification of our hearts, which it's remarkable how effective the conscious cultivation of loving kindness is. And if you don't know the formal practices, learn it. We do it here every now and then, but if you don't know it, find out. And then make it a central part of your daily remembering of your true nature. And I already spoke of the last of the paramis, which is the last of the seven factors of enlightenment, the last of the Brahma-viharas, and the last of the paramis is the expression of the deepest understanding, is that unshakable balance of mind of equanimity, which includes all of the other Brahma-viharas of love, of compassion, of joy, and yet allows the joys and the sorrows to be experienced without losing, without falling into greed, or not falling into despair, opening our heart to the world, but being able to stay wide open, our heart as wide as the world, to have that impartial, sky-like openness to whatever presents itself. And each of us has that as our birthright, the capacity to have that kind of equanimity, that kind of balance. It's home. And it's really a matter of not straying away from ourselves, and it's a matter of cultivating these qualities that help us stay here. So that's all I wanted to say. If there are any questions or comments, descriptions, we have a microphone. Please, Tanya, welcome. You want the mic or do you? When the incident in Connecticut. I'm going to repeat for the purpose of people listening from afar. Yes, during the 26 acts of kindness, some people were doing it. Maybe you can question everything you do and ask yourself, is this kind?
Like, I'm honking my horn at someone to go. Is that kind?
Great. So noticing what's unkind as well as...
And it's actually a really nice shortcut.
Great.
And I just thought...
Beautiful. Thank you.
I'm not great at it yet, but I mean, I'm trying.
Yes.
And I think it can be helpful. It's kind of in line with what you were saying.
Great. Beautiful. Yeah. It can be all very creative. You don't have to follow any cookie-cutter approach to kindness. Is what I'm saying, doing, or thinking kind?
Because then it brings in generosity. Oh, I want to be kind.
I want to be kind.
Or
beautiful.
Self-awareness.
Great.
I think I said that.
No, you're doing great. Thank you. Thank you. Please, Heidi Jane. I'm not sure I could speak about resolve and letting go. I'm not sure I could do it short. another time, I'd love to. But I'd say a good practice is resolve to let go. No, I really appreciate the question. It's actually a deep question about when to, how long to stay with things, and when to. Yeah, when it shades into clinging, when there's clinging, when your suffering is because you're dependent on a result, that's usually the time to let go. Doesn't mean let go of the efforts, it means let go of the dependency on the result. Please. Oh, a little bit more about non-harming. Well, in the general teachings, the encouragement is especially for daily life to keep 5 training guidelines: to not cause harm with our, to not kill, not steal. So have a reverence for life, not take that which is not offered freely, and to not cause harm with our sexuality. That means to be sensitive to whether what's driving your sexuality. Is it just lust, or is it caring? And to be very discerning about, because there's so much harm caused with sexuality. To not cause harm with our speech, to speak truthfully in a timely way for the benefit of whoever we may be speaking to, and to speak harmoniously, not harshly, and not to gossip, to see if, as a practice, we can avoid, as one of my teachers did, avoid talking about third persons, somebody not present. And finally, not causing harm through our carelessness and heedlessness that comes from the excessive use of intoxicants. So to refrain from toxicants to the point that they cause carelessness and heedlessness. Some would say to refrain altogether. So that's basically, and the idea that whatever harm you cause yourself. There's just no other. And that to act to do unto others as you would want to have done unto you. So I think that's about all the time we have tonight. And I appreciate all of you sitting through the evening and being here, and I'd just like us to just have 10 seconds or 30 seconds of quiet to remember once again that we don't exist independently apart from each other, that we, as Thich Nhat Hanh said, we inter-are, that inter-being is the center, is the deepest nature of our existence, and that all of our actions of body, speech, and mind have reverberations, and even coming here tonight has reverberations. And we make that conscious by dedicating any goodness, any blessings, any benefits, any fruits that have arisen from our practice. We dedicate whatever blessings to the welfare and benefit of all beings. And we wish for all beings, just as we wish for ourselves, that we be happy and peaceful. And we wish for all beings that we are safe and protected from both inner harm and outer harm. May we be safe, and may all beings be safe. And due to our practice, may all beings feel healthy and strong and learn to accept theirs and our limitations with grace. And a deep wish that all beings, including ourselves, can have ease in our hearts and a sense of well-being. And a deep wish that all beings realize the sacred happiness that's without sorrow, here and now, realize our true nature, that all beings can be liberated, can realize what has never been truly lost. May all beings be liberated. And may our practice touch the hearts of all beings. So, thank you for your practice. Thanks for your generosity. And hope to see you next time. That's for you, David. Thank you. Come back again. Where do you live?